This is a CBC podcast.
We are resuming funding to UNRWA because of the dire humanitarian situation on the ground. UNRWA forms the backbone of the humanitarian response in Gaza.
International Development Minister Ahmed Hussein announcing Canada is restoring UNRWA's funding. But what about the allegations from Israel that some of the UN agency staff were involved in the October 7th attacks? I'm Catherine Cullen. This week on The House, Ambassador Bob Rae on why the government is restoring the relief agency's funding now. Also, this wildfire season will be another tough one. A top executive from the United States Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, on how our countries can work together to be more resilient in the face of climate change. And foreign interference through video games? Why the Canadian government is trying to stop it. But first, how Canada decided to reinstate funding for UNRWA. The House is now in session. Canada was one of the first countries to suspend UNRWA funding after Israel alleged 12 employees of the agency were involved in the October 7th attacks. Now, that funding is being restored. In fact, Canada never missed a payment. Bob Rae is Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. I spoke with him Friday. Ambassador, welcome back to the House.
Thank you very much.
So what information did the government receive that led to this decision to restart funding?
I don't think it was so much about information as the need for us to be able to engage with a whole range of partners, other donors, the UN itself. We just had a visit this week from Sigrid Kaag, who's responsible for coordinating all of the efforts that are being made now in the region. And so we wanted to get all that lined up before we made an announcement about, you know, where money would be going and how it would be going. But at the same time, we wanted to make it very clear that UNRWA will have to be, needs to be, part of what we do for the time being because it is playing such a critical role on the ground, and the situation on the ground is so dire. And so that's why we're doing what we're doing.
So just to be clear, is this decision in any way about the culpability or the exoneration of UNRWA when it comes to these allegations by Israel?
Not at all. There's only been a partial report from the first investigation, and that investigation has not yet had the opportunity to meet with the government of Israel. The Secretary General wrote to the government of Israel at the end of January asking for full cooperation with this UN investigation team. And to this point, the Israeli government has not shared any detailed information with respect to the original allegations of the 12 employees. So we decided that this is taking a very long time. We can't wait now because of the situation on the ground to make it clear that we think that what has been put in place in terms of the additional investigations, reviews, audits, all of that's happening in real time with UNRWA. And at the same time, we have an unprecedented humanitarian disaster going on. So we need to respond to the humanitarian situation as effectively as we can. But talking to the UN officials, as we've been doing here in New York and elsewhere, it's very clear that it's extremely difficult to get stuff into Gaza at the moment, and there is sufficient funding to back up what needs to get in. The key issue for us now is if there is a ceasefire, then presumably it will be easier to get stuff in very, very quickly, and that's what we have to be ready to do. And so Canada's lining up with all of our friends and other donors, with nonprofit agencies, and with the UN itself, to make sure that we're going to be ready to do as effective a job as we can as the situation unfolds. It's a very difficult situation, and we're responding to it.
I just want to be crystal clear about Canada's stance on all of this, because a moment ago you referenced conversations that had yet to happen with Israel. Are you saying that if Israel had been more forthcoming, had those conversations provided more evidence that this pause might still be in place?
I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that the priority for the government has always been the humanitarian needs on the ground. The government made its decision to pause, and at the same time, it announced an additional $40 million for other agencies. As it has unfolded, it's become even clearer that the infrastructure, the buildings, the expertise, the staff that UNRWA has with respect to the delivery of humanitarian assistance is really, it's a part of what everybody else is doing. So if it's the World Food Program, they do it in cooperation with UNRWA. If we give money to Canadian agencies, they often do it in cooperation with UNRWA. So the reality on the ground is that UNRWA will continue to be part of what goes on. And that's why we made the decision. As long as we've got the investigations and reviews underway, we think what we're doing is responsible, and we think it gives the humanitarian assistance the priority that it must have at the moment. Children are starving. People are dying. There's not enough food getting in. That must be the priority for everybody, including Israel, because we can't do this without Israel fully cooperating with the need for humanitarian relief.
Two Liberal MPs, Anthony Housefather and Marco Mendicino, put out a statement in advance of this official announcement, raising concerns about the prospect of refunding UNRWA. It says, in part, given its history, we believe that UNRWA lacks sufficient governance and internal controls to ensure that humanitarian aid delivered by Canada will be reliably delivered to those who actually need it. And there is a serious risk the funds will be misappropriated by Hamas. What do you say to people, Ambassador, including these two Liberal MPs, who say UNRWA can no longer be trusted and they haven't seen public evidence to the contrary?
I don't agree with their assessment. I don't think it's true what they're actually saying, that the measures are not in place to ensure that funding is used in any way to support UNRWA. I honestly don't believe that's happening or is going to happen. I think the critical point for us to put in place in response to the individuals and others who will express concerns is to say the United Nations and the countries that are donors are doing everything we can to ensure that we meet two separate tests, and they're each critically important. The first test is to make sure that humanitarian assistance gets to people who are dying and starving. And everybody has to appreciate the seriousness of that problem. It is a critical problem. There's a prospect of famine here, and we have to respond to that. And the second test is to ensure that measures and additional measures are put in place, in addition to the ones that are already in place, to ensure that UNRWA is indeed well-governed and that it is able to respond to the situation. But we can't let the second interfere with the humanitarian priority. And that, I think, is behind the government's decision. The government is very aware of all of the issues that have been gone on for some time with respect to what is up with UNRWA, but we're also very well aware of the nature of the humanitarian disaster that is upon us. And this is no time for academic responses. We have to respond in real time to what is a critical situation. And that is what the government of Canada is doing. And I don't just think it's the right thing to do. I think it's essential that we do this.
Ambassador, I do want to ask you very quickly about the idea of airdrops. Minister Husin first raised that on this program a couple of weeks ago. Now the government is putting resources towards that via Jordan. Since then, though, the Americans have begun these airdrops of aid. There's been reports that, in fact, several people were actually killed when a parachute failed to deploy. Aid groups have said the aid is not reaching the people who need it most, who are vulnerable. This is more of a sort of survival of the fittest, who can get to the aid first situation. Why is Canada embracing this model?
I don't think we're embracing any model or another model. I think we're doing everything we can to respond to a situation where we can't get enough where it needs to get in. And the key thing is it needs to get through the road routes that allow us and the gates and the entrances to Gaza that allow it to get in. That is absolutely the preferred route. which, by the way, is the reason why we're unpausing with respect to UNRWA. I think the reason for the airdrops is that, look, the situation is desperate. And if we can work with others to ensure that it is safe and that it helps, it sends a signal to the citizens living in Gaza, to the people living in Gaza, that the world has not forgotten them, that the world is aware of their tragedy, then we will respond. But is it, you know, is it the perfect solution? No, of course not. There is no doubt at all that the airdrops are simply a reflection of how tough it is to get the assistance in where it's needed. And we're looking at all options. President Biden announced last night of the possibility of doing it by sea and establishing a port that would allow that to happen. Canada will obviously be exploring that with our American colleagues. Again, an example of how people are improvising in an attempt to respond to a very desperate situation. And as we join in that process, and we have been thoroughly joined up in that process, we want to make it clear that at this point in time, we do not see an alternative to including UNRWA in the package of things that we do to respond to the humanitarian crisis. And that's why Minister Hussein made his statement yesterday.
Quickly, before I let you go, I must ask you about the situation in Haiti. As we are speaking, gangs have been pushing for the ouster of Prime Minister Ariel Henry. In January of last year, you said on this show that Haiti was holding together by a thread. Did the international community do enough to avoid this moment?
Simple answer is no, but here we are. And so we don't have the luxury of crying over spilt milk. I will be joining the CARICOM meeting in Kingston on Sunday evening and for the day on Monday, and meeting with UN officials at the senior level who will be there. Senior American officials will be there. A bunch of other folks will be there from the EU, from the UK, and all over. We're all now trying to figure out, okay, what can we do to get a transitional government in place that will allow us to move towards elections and at the same time restore order. It is absolutely essential that order be created in order for us to be able to do the humanitarian work, the development work, and to move us towards a democratic prospect for Haiti. Nobody's imposing anything. The people of Haiti have asked us for this. They've asked us for help. We're going to be meeting with our Caribbean partners to see what more needs to be done. But there's no denying it's a desperate situation. And when I have no hesitation in saying, has the world done enough to respond to Haiti? The answer is no, it hasn't. But there's no point in pointing fingers. We just have to pitch in and figure out how to make a difference.
Ambassador Barbre, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
You as well.
None of us were happy to see information that more than half of our trucks, more than half of our planes, and more than half of our ships are not available for service because they are in need of parts and repair. And so we're going to have to do better.
Defense Minister Bill Blair on the state of the Canadian military. He was speaking to a conference of defense and security experts in Ottawa this week. Documents obtained by CBC News reveal if NATO were to call on the Canadian Armed Forces right now, only 58% of the military would be able to respond. And almost half of the military's equipment, trucks, guns, planes, ships, is considered unavailable and unserviceable. Murray Brewster broke this story. He's the CBC's senior defense reporter. Murray, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Catherine.
So the figures are pretty shocking. That description from Bill Blair, not exactly encouraging. How bad is this?
I'm going to steal a phrase from Vice Admiral Mark Norman, who in my story said this is borderline atrocious. Mm. I can speak personally and say in almost 20 years of covering defense, I've not really seen the numbers this bad. So as you pointed out, it's important because when NATO calls, Canada is expected by treaty to have certain forces available. We have an international environment right now where things are very uncertain. And in Europe, they are very nervous about Russia expanding the war in Ukraine to include other parts of Europe. And for readiness in the Canadian Armed Forces to be where it is right now, I've heard other defense officials describe this as alarming. The biggest problem they face is the fact that they are down 15,780 members. That's according to figures that were current as of December 31st. But also, too, they have aging equipment. And that's a problem because when you are going to use the equipment that you have, a lot of it, because it's so old, spends a lot of time in maintenance. And in some cases, there's no spare parts. The best example I can give you is our Leopard tanks, some of which we sent to Ukraine, but others that were sent to Latvia. And those tanks don't have a lot of spare parts, so they can't be used.
We hear these warnings about the state of the military. I wonder if you can just really put your finger on, Murray, what is at stake here?
Well, what's at stake is the military's ability to be able to respond to the requests of the federal government, be it domestically or be it internationally. If the Canadian military is called upon to do something, either at home or abroad, and they can't do it, then that's a major problem for the Canadian government.
So how did we get here?
It's been decades in the making. I've been covering this beat again for almost two decades, and the funding of the military has always been an issue. Equipment has always been an issue. It's been an issue pretty much since the end of the Cold War. And we're at a point now where previous governments, liberal and conservative, have just kicked these problems down the road. And what's interesting, though, is that I think Canadians are starting to become alive to the concerns. A lot of it, I'm sure, is being driven by all of the bad news that's coming from overseas. But we saw in polls recently, this week, three separate polls showing that an increasing number of Canadians are not only in favor of higher defense spending, but they're concerned about the Canadian military's ability to be able to respond. And I spoke with Vice Admiral Mark Norman, retired Vice Admiral Mark Norman, about the perception of the polls. And he had some very interesting things to say about that.
I don't want us to fall into the trap of doing something just because it may be popular or seen to be popular from the perspective of polling and popular opinion. We need to do it because it's the right thing to do. We need to do it because the government has an obligation to do it. We need to do it because we've told our allies would do it. And fundamentally, we need to do it because the world in which we are living is not the world that we thought it was 30, 20, or even 10 years ago.
Now, Carrie Buck was our former ambassador to NATO, and she also expanded on this point and talked about how it's important for Canadians to be paying attention.
I think it puts the current government and the opposition out of step with what Canadians are expecting. I'd like to see an all-party discussion about current security environment. I'd love to see a national security strategy. Love to see an integrated foreign policy strategy. I think they're out of step. I mean, to be fair for this government, they when they issued Strong, Secure, Engage, which is the current defense policy, there was a promised 73% rise in defense spending, which is one of the biggest increases that we've seen in decades. They haven't been able to deliver on that.
The government response has been to point to all the investments they say that they're making in equipment and a promise to do better. But how does that square with the cuts to the defense budget they've also announced?
It doesn't. The upcoming federal budget, we've seen the estimates, and the estimates are suggesting there's going to be a $79 million cut to ready forces. Now, what that means is less money for training, less money for spare parts, but it's being redirected, of course, within the Defense Department to buy the equipment that they need.
We're about to speak on the program about natural disasters, and we know Canada's military has played a significant role in helping out in the aftermath. How do the kind of challenges that you're reporting on, Murray, intersect with those demands here at home?
Well, here at home, the Canadian Armed Forces has been the force of first resort for the Canadian government in terms of fighting wildfires or cleaning up after floods or anything like that. And to have a force that is not ready or its readiness is under strain means that they're not going to be able to potentially respond to some of that, or they're not going to be able to be out there as long as they would like to be. And we have seen the Canadian Armed Forces last year spend 141 straight days on domestic operations. So they may not be able to be there when Canadians respond because of the readiness and the absence of equipment.
A lot to think about here. Thank you very much for your reporting on this, Murray.
You're welcome.
The CBC's Murray Brewster, senior defense reporter here in Ottawa. As Murray just said, we've really leaned on Canada's military during recent natural disasters. It's been 6 months since Yellowknife residents were able to return home after wildfires forced them to evacuate. Now that city and the rest of Canada is looking down the start of another tough fire season. So, how prepared are we? Rebecca Alty is Yellowknife's mayor. Welcome to the House.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start by asking you how your city is different than it was before the fires last summer.
I think the big physical thing that people would notice was the number of fire breaks. A fire break is a jargony term, I realize, but that's where we cut down a lot of trees, and I kind of compared it to like creating a moat around the castle. All the outside of our community, we created those fire breaks. And I know this winter, the one in particular on the west side of the community, that's where the fire was coming from that direction, has been had a lot of use from snowmobilers and people looking to get out, because it's now this big lane from the highway all the way to the lake. So there was also another trail created, but those are, I would say, the big things that people would notice in Yellowknife.
Now that you are having to get ready for another fire season, I mean, what is that like for you and the folks in the city who presumably, I imagine in some way, you're still recovering from what happened last summer?
Yeah, exactly. I'd say it's been full speed ahead on emergency preparedness starting last May and going up to today and continuing on throughout the summer. So once the evacuation was lifted and people were coming home, that's when we moved into the recovery phase and the preparation for the next season. So doing the analysis internally on, you know, what should have happened, what did happen, and starting to work on ways to improve. In that process, I'd say some of the big things is working with the territorial government on evacuation preparedness for residents. We are updating our community wildfire plan. And because the wildfire plan looks at all the risks to the community and how we can mitigate them. And so we had a plan from 2019, but last year, because we did all those fire breaks, we basically completed most of those recommendations from that plan. So now we're looking to update the plan. Do we have any further risks and how can we mitigate them? So we're looking to get that document complete by May. And then following that is what we call a pre-plan. So that's an operational plan. So any area where we've identified a risk, we create a plan to how we're going to mitigate that.
As you're having these conversations, do you find that most of the people you represent, are they anxious to know that this is happening, or is there a resistance to having to, you know, really engage with the idea of another potential very difficult time?
I think residents are happy to hear when all the work that's underway. They want to, and I would say that there's a bit of anxiety in the fact that so much of the work is done behind the scenes, and then because they're like operational plans, so it might not look like we're doing stuff. Part of that is we're also looking to increase our communications leading up to the season. Starting, we will have a presentation at our council meeting, which is public and open, Monday, March 18th at lunch. And so the territorial government's going to come and present to council on what they're doing to prepare for the season. We're going to talk about what we're doing to prepare for the season. There's a number of workshops that are going to be held over the spring, from like the after-action assessment where residents can come and talk about their experience. We're hosting a fire smarting workshop. So a lot of the behind-the-scenes work that's been happening since the fire is people are going to start to see that momentum now coming out in the public. So they'll be able to engage more and learn more.
Would you say you feel ready?
Yeah, I think we, you know, well, we always want more time in the day to do X, Y, and Z, and staff have been working full tilt since then. The key is to, you know, you never know what Mother Nature is going to throw your way, and that's where we're working on all these plans, from what happens if the fire is going to impact Yellowknife, or if Yellowknife's going to be the reception center again. So how can we mobilize and be a host community again? So do I wish there's more time in the day so we could do even more? Yes, but we're working hard to make sure that there's plans in place for the variety of scenarios.
We've only got a moment left, but what is the most significant thing you need other levels of government to do to bolster that readiness?
Money. The fact is that as a municipality, we receive $0 for emergency preparedness to do all this work. And so, you know, in our core funding, that's really where we need dollars so that we can be prepared. There's plenty of money if an emergency happens, but there's none of that front-end money. And so that's where really encouraging the other levels of government to invest in the emergency preparedness and not just the recovery. So again, we appreciate the financial support we received during the emergency, but how can we invest more in our communities? Because municipalities are the poorest level of government. And, you know, for every dollar in taxes, 10 cents goes to a municipality. So we need more money to be able to be prepared for these events.
Mayor Alty, I really appreciate this chance to speak to you, and we wish you and everybody in your community the best.
Thank you.
Yellowknife Mayor Rebecca Alty. We asked Emergency Preparedness Minister Harjit Sajjan's office for their take on the need for more money. They noted it's provinces and territories that are primarily responsible, but that they're aware that more investment is needed to prevent major disasters, and they're working with the provinces and territories to provide more resources. You heard there about a city in recovery, bracing for the future, trying to be resilient. In the United States, some people within the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, have thought a lot about what it means to be resilient in the face of disaster.
It's really the ability of individuals, of families, of communities, and even our nation to understand risk, understand what might happen, and to take action. And that looks like being prepared. It looks like doing everything you can to reduce the risks that you face, and then being able to really withstand adversity and recover quickly.
Victoria Salinas is the Deputy Administrator for Resilience with FEMA. We met her on the sidelines of the Ottawa Conference on Security and Defense. I asked her about Canada and the United States cooperating more to tackle disasters and what that might look like.
The United States and Canada have had a really positive working relationship and partnership for decades when it comes to emergency preparedness. We do joint exercises and training, and so there's this really robust activity that happens across our borders and in our adjacent communities. What we're starting to see, and it's I think we're at the beginning of this really exciting progress, is communities coming together around disaster risk reduction as well. And so we've got a couple of places, different communities on two sides of the border that are looking at flood risk and figuring out how they work jointly together. And so I think we're going to see an expansion of that because one of the things that we do, we have shared ecosystems, right? Just because there may be a border between us doesn't mean that our rivers, our mountains, our landscapes experience those same borders. And so the solutions are oftentimes going to be interconnected.
The minister referenced a NORAD-type operation, and I think it does sort of conjure to mind the sharing of these forces that are trying to combat, let's say, a wildfire. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you're talking about there, or does that go above and beyond where the discussion is?
So I think there's different parts of it. Like when it comes to disaster response, we absolutely have agreements in place to provide surge support to Canada and vice versa. Provinces and states also have different types of mutual aid agreements in place. We'll likely continue to see those things continue to be utilized when either nation is feeling overwhelmed. We will also start to see, I believe, more partnership in the resilience building space because of the connectedness of our challenges and the fact that climate-related disasters don't respect boundaries. And even last year with like the wildfires that you all were having, we were directly affected. I live in Washington, D.C. We were having the secondhand smoke from that. And so walking to work, one could smell it. And people are having secondary health impacts. And so I think in that resilience building risk reduction space, we'll absolutely continue to see the strength of the relationship be helpful as we tackle new challenges together.
A big part of the conversation here in Canada is about who does the work, whether it's reasonable to keep bringing our military in when we have some of these natural disasters. What are your thoughts about the importance of who responds to future disasters?
The issue of who responds to natural disasters is one that is really important to look at. And in the U.S. context, with the increased frequency of disasters, it's one where local governments are having to build more capacity because the federal level only really comes and helps when both the local government and the state government are overwhelmed. And so with more smaller disasters, flooding can happen that makes it hard for people to get to school, makes it hard to get to work, makes it hard to just have your livelihood. But it may not be a federal disaster, so the federal government's not going to be coming to support. And so that's why I say that it's so critical for local government to really build that capability. And very few local governments in the United States are resourced to do that. And so it's really partnership. It's partnerships with nonprofits, faith-based organizations, those organizations that already have high trust from the communities that they're in, that are actually part of a community response, really leveraging the local community assets and bringing different organizations into response, recovery, rebuilding, resilience, has this positive reinforcing effect because you're strengthening those social bonds at the local level, which provides the first line of defense, but also the safety net that people need from folks that are trusted, from folks that know the unique needs of the communities who are affected.
You are so seized with this issue. Visibly, I can see your passion about it when you speak. You talk about the Canada-U.S. relationship as being one that's going to continue to be there for us. I know there's going to be someone listening to this interview who goes, well, that might depend on politics. And I wonder what you would say to people in Canada about the future strength of this relationship as things get more and more challenging.
One of the things that I find very heartening is that the relationships transcend government and politics. FEMA has 10 different regions across the nation, and when we look at the local level, we have specific cities and towns along the border who are working with the cities and towns on the other side of the border. They're starting to look at shared risks. They're starting to look at shared opportunities to build resilience. And regardless of national politics, we have seen time and time again, administration over administration, how it's local leaders working with each other that drive innovation. And that innovation is not going to stop because local leaders who are committed to helping their people stay focused on that mission. And so that's something that I think we'll continue to see is as people better understand risk, they understand their shared futures, that local leaders who share ecosystems, who share mountains, who share rivers, they will continue to figure out how to make sure that they're living in harmony with Mother Nature so the impacts of climate change are not causing the human suffering that would occur if they didn't take action together.
Well, I was going to ask you what gives you hope, but I'm pretty sure that was just about the most hopeful thing we could hope to hear in this conversation. It was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Victoria Salinas is the Deputy Administrator for Resilience with FEMA. Lots more coming up on the House podcast. Ghana's so-called anti-gay bill has passed its parliament. Meet the woman fighting to get the Commonwealth, including Canada, to do more to stop repressive policies.
Canada has a role to play, whether this is silent or quiet diplomacy, and having these bilateral conversations with other officials around the world. I'd like to see Canada continue its commitments to resourcing partners in Commonwealth countries which face harm, persecution, torture, or even the death penalty.
We'll introduce you to Lady Phil in about 6 minutes. I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to Canada's most popular political affairs program. A new episode of The House drops every Saturday. Let us know what you think about what you hear. Send us an email, thehouse@cbc.ca. We've covered national security and foreign interference a lot here on The House, but those topics don't usually come up in the same breath as video games. Now, let me back up here for a second. Just before last weekend, two ministers quietly released a statement that explained the government would be taking a closer look at foreign investments in interactive digital media. The Heritage and Innovation ministers say that includes video games and that they'll be paying particular attention to money coming from foreign states that, quote, engage in activities that may pose a risk to Canada's national security. So, what does it all mean, and how is Canada's video game industry absorbing it? Joining me from studio in Vancouver is Ryan Black. He's a tech lawyer. His clients include video game companies. He's also a gamer himself. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us here on The House.
Thanks so much for having me.
When you saw this statement come out late last week, what was your reaction?
Blindsided a little bit to the extent that I think it came out of a bit of nowhere for me. I read it and it said, I would say nothing particularly controversial other than the need to focus on this or their decision to release this on a Friday afternoon. It struck me as a surprising timing given the state of the current games industry.
I tried to get a bit more information about this, and I was told that this is something that the government had been working on. This is really an issue that they're seized with. As you look at the statement the government put out, as you and others in the industry have had time to absorb it, what do you think it is that they're responding to here?
Well, I think globally we've seen a number of countries start to invest in the games industry as a growing industry, as one, you know, where they can experience a good place to park their money, a good place to invest and grow, a good place to secure talent. And Canada has a world-class games development talent pool. You know, these countries that are starting to invest, you know, have been doing it since the mid-2010s. Come from places like China and Saudi Arabia that, you know, I think to some degree there might be some level of discomfort at the government about the degree to which foreign states or people with cultural values, I think that the government highlights in the statement, you know, cultural values that don't necessarily reflect Canadian cultural values, control these companies. And taking a step back, the purpose of the legislation on which they do this review is to allow the government of Canada to kind of protect Canadian culture, protect Canadian cultural businesses, and that includes video game companies. And so, you know, the degree to which they're now reviewing this suggests to me that they've become concerned that, you know, a foreign state or foreign-owned entities are starting to influence Canadian culture in the games industry.
Yeah, the statement specifically talks about concerns about spreading disinformation, manipulating information. We were certainly curious about the national security implications, and we came across a study from last fall out of Lund University in Sweden, funded by the country's Psychological Defense Agency. It looks at the vulnerabilities that exist in the gaming world. As many as 40 types, they found, of vulnerabilities that could be exploited by foreign actors. I'd like you to listen to with me a bit of a conversation I had with one of the study's co-authors, Jesper Falkheimer, who offered some examples.
The most simple example is obviously when a foreign state tries to hijack somehow a game and develop narratives and messages inside of a game that are propagandistic or an example of disinformation. Russia, as one example, has influenced somehow the messaging in kids' games, actually, like Roblox and Minecraft and so on.
What kind of thing might a child come across in one of these games?
I think they might come across narratives where the heroes have Russian uniforms, basically. It was actually also mentioned by Putin in a speech he made that the gaming scene is a very interesting scene for spreading, in his perspective, positive propaganda around Russia. I would say this whole field is pretty new and unresearched, so we don't really have any systematic knowledge so far. But we do know that foreign states, hostile foreign states, spend more resources on this than ever.
Ryan Black, what do you think when you hear that?
I think it's theoretically possible that that may happen, although when I think about the popular games that people are playing, and you know, 99% of people probably under, I think, the age of 18, I heard, play games, it's a significant percentage even above that. You know, if you have a mobile app on your phone, you're playing games. Most of those games aren't pushing a narrative about, you know, people that we wouldn't want to be heroes being heroes. Most of those games are pushing narratives that are about fun gameplay or social cooperation or things like that. It strikes me that games is an interesting area where, like, I grew up playing games where, you know, I had to choose in, for example, a World War One multiplayer battle game where I had to choose between whether I was going to be on the Axis or the Allies side. And it wasn't particularly because I wanted to pick one side or the other. It was because, you know, on this team they needed my play type and on this team they didn't. And I don't think that the narrative of that was really moving anyone's needle.
So how do you think that this increased scrutiny will play out in the industry?
Well, I think it's a really precarious time to signal to the external investment community that the government is going to be looking more closely at foreign investment. The Canadian games industry has relied on foreign investment to grow. It's been a substantial part of the way that studios have gotten access to capital. Games are very expensive to make as the fidelity goes up and as the player expectations go up. And, you know, we're in a cycle in the industry right now where it's unfortunately been post-COVID in a little bit of a downturn. You know, there was quite a lot of excitement during the pandemic about the growth of games. That has cooled off a little bit since then. So, you know, the timing of this in March, while studios are announcing layoffs and cutbacks and canceling titles, the timing of telling foreign investors we're going to more closely scrutinize your investments into the game industry just seemed very poorly timed to me.
It leaves us with so many questions. Ryan Black, I appreciate you shedding some light on what we do understand about this. Thank you very much.
Of course, happy to help.
Tech lawyer Ryan Black in Vancouver. The prospect of changing policies around gender, particularly in Alberta, has been a hot political topic in this country. My next guest is focused on laws involving LGBTQ plus people across the Commonwealth. Right now, Ghana is poised to pass a law that would put people in prison for being in same-sex relationships or promoting LGBTQ activities. There, the punishment for the charge of aggravated homosexuality is the death penalty. Is there anything the Commonwealth as a group can do to address these regressive laws? Phil Opoku-Jima is the secretary of the Commonwealth Equality Network, and she is in Ottawa this week. Lady Phil, welcome to the House.
Thank you so much for having me, Catherine.
Really glad to have this conversation. To start, what is it about the dynamics in these particular countries? Like Ghana, for instance, there is an election that they are on the cusp of later this year. How does that figure into the timing of this particular law or potential law?
Like with any election, so Ghana will have its general election on the 7th of December this year. We know that there's always an amount of scapegoating that goes into a particular community or group of people. I think the timing just feels horrendous. The bill itself is horrendous, so the timing couldn't be any worse. We're seeing groups of people who are fearing for their lives, groups of people who know they will not be free or equal or have any sort of justice, even though that's Ghana's motto. So whilst we're on this run-up to the general election, we're going to see probably a lot more people either, and just a quick trigger warning, a lot more people lose their life, take their life, or be so isolated in the lives that they're leading.
So why is the Commonwealth a vehicle for dealing with this, do you think?
Well, I think the Commonwealth is an aspect for dealing with these draconian pieces of legislation. And you've only got to look back at history to understand that the Commonwealth was the institution or the body, as in empire, colonialism, who left a lot of these sodomy laws in places around Africa, Asia, the Caribbean and the Pacific. So in changing that, the Commonwealth have a duty, they have a responsibility to help partners, capacity build, movement build, and change the trajectory of how we lead our lives.
You've been having conversations in Canada this week. How is that suggestion received by people in Canada, that there is a role? Obviously, if there's a role for the Commonwealth, there is a role for Canada to take here too.
I think Canada is very open. The fact that I had a really brilliant meeting with Global Affairs Canada and other government officials and policymakers, legislators in a room, we asked the hard question about how honest do you want us to be? And the fact that you have your truth and reconciliation, where there's a long way to go, this room was really open to hearing some of the hard truths and figuring out, well, what sort of recommendations can we take away to do better and be better?
Help me understand that a little bit better. Like, what you're talking about, speaking hard truths to some of the Canadian officials you met with?
Yeah.
And what? Give me an example.
I guess it's really easy when you're in a role and you're a policymaker to look at legislation and look at it in a pragmatic way, but not necessarily think about those on the ground that are living the real experiences of trying to navigate laws that harm them. So if you're in a space with these policymakers and they're like, Okay, well, help us understand the lived experience so it can be translated into the work that they do. That, for me, was powerful within itself.
Can you give me an example of the kind of lived experience you're talking about?
Yes, some of the lived experiences that we are seeing partners on the ground, and let me speak specifically to Ghana, who are unable to access health. So whether they have HIV or any other ailment or disability or disease that needs tending to because of the fear of leaving their homes, you've got a lack of safe spaces where we have seen 21 people, this was last year, arrested in a parish or constituency called Ho, and they were detained for over 18 days without any access to legal support.
And this was on, I guess, suspicion of...
This was on suspicion of promoting homosexuality. But what it was a training course that was empowering them to feel more adept and articulate in the work that they had to do.
Okay. So when it comes to this question, you've answered the question of why you believe the Commonwealth can be one of the vehicles for taking action. What about the what? What is it that you would like to see the Commonwealth and Canada specifically do?
Well, I think Canada has a role to play in whether this is silent or quiet diplomacy and having these bilateral conversations with other officials around the world. I'd like to see Canada use a lot more its power and its influence in institutions and actors and bodies such as the ERC, which is the Equal Rights Coalition, which is made up of member states. I'd like to see Canada continue its commitments to resourcing partners in Commonwealth countries which face harm, persecution, torture, or even the death penalty, as you rightfully pointed out with what's happening in Uganda.
Before I let you go, I would like to talk a bit about what's happening in Canada right now. As I said at the beginning, there is a debate in some provinces around trans children and adults, what pronouns children use at school, who needs to be informed, when puberty blockers can be used, what surgery should be available, what bathrooms people should be able to use. What's your impression of how this debate is unfolding in Canada?
I think the debate is absolutely toxic. I feel we should not be debating trans people's lives, but we should much rather listen to their lived experience about how we can support and help better the access to health, the access to education, the access to knowledge that they wish for themselves. This debate around trans and gender identity and gender expression has taken a really different form in the hate that is spouted towards our trans siblings. I really want to make it clear, and I'm glad you've invited me onto the show, to say I do not see trans people as a threat. And no one else should see trans people as a threat. We should see them very much as this is how to be resilient. We've seen way too many trans and non-binary children and adults take their lives. So what we should be doing is, what does the education look like and what do the safe spaces look like for us to have this discourse as opposed to debating what toilets they use?
What would you say to a parent who is listening right now and says, well, I'm not trying to engage in a toxic discourse and I'm not saying trans people are a threat, but I am saying that I believe I should know what's happening with my child at their school when they are a minor?
Absolutely. As a mother myself, I want to know what my child is doing, what they're going through, and understanding where they're coming from.
What pronouns they're using at school.
Pronouns are very important. If that's how you wish to identify, then that's important. But the debate is what has turned toxic. And there's a difference between debate and dialogue. And I think it's dialogue that we need more than debates.
What advice would you give then to talk about these issues, which, as you say, are fundamental, but to not have an element of toxicity in it, as you put it?
I think the advice I'd give to myself as a mother, if my child was of the trans experience, is that be gentle, be kind, be patient, and try and work and learn together.
Same advice for politicians then?
Ooh, might be a bit stronger for our politicians, but I would still advise politicians to understand that the agenda should not be siloed. It is part and parcel of how we want to see a diverse and intersectional and a beautiful society.
Lady Phil, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lady Phil is the Secretary of the Commonwealth Equality Network. That is it for us this week. Our crew here on The House is Emma Godmier, Christian Posling, and our senior producer this week is Kristen Everson. But thanks also to Jennifer Chevalier. I'm Catherine Cullen. Thank you so much for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.